I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Anne Tumlinson. Anne has spent her career working to improve the way we care for frail older adults, including people experiencing dementia. Despite her expertise, Anne felt unprepared when the time came to help her own family and friends. And from that experience, she founded a nonprofit organization called Daughterhood, or daughterhood.org, which provides community and connection to family caregivers, and where she also posts regular blogs. On the professional side, Anne heads up a consultancy firm in Washington, D.C. called ATI Advisory, which helps clients navigate the vast complexities of the healthcare system. One of Anne's passions is developing policy that supports families and caregivers, including the GUIDE model, which we'll be talking about very soon. Welcome to Remo, Anne.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
So before we met today, I was reading about you online and poking around your website, and I stumbled across this quote that I really loved. And you wrote, "I've learned that nothing prepares you for the experience of caring for another person, not even being an expert on the topic." So could you tell us a little bit about your personal forays into caregiving?
My interest in aging policy started with caregiving for my grandparents, which was minimal, really. I was third in line for caregiving duties after spouses and my parents. But I was very close to my grandparents. And one of the last things that my grandparents on my dad's side did was to go on a trip with me as a 21-year-old, driving them halfway across the country. So I was caregiving and driving. It was a little bit like something right out of Thelma and Louise. It was really the whole way in the car. My grandmother was sitting there. She read literally every single road sign to me for two solid days of driving. But that experience and many others is what pushed me in the direction of working on aging issues early in my career, and then beginning to really specialize in things like the healthcare system. And then more recently and more saliently, I've been working in public policy on how do we pay for things, all of the technicalities of healthcare and aging. And as family members and friends, my aunt, my neighbors, people like that would come to me and ask me questions, I had one of those life-changing moments where I realized that even though I understand deeply all of the economic aspects of healthcare, I didn't actually really understand how it played out at the ground level. You know, in the conversation between the physician and the older adult and the caregiver in the physician's office, and then what happens exactly after that, and just being so struck by how hard it is to find the resources, to find the pathway that you're going to go down. Everybody I talked to, it seemed like they were all creating their very own healthcare delivery system, you know, all by themselves in their houses. I didn't realize this. 20 years working on aging issues, I didn't know it. That was a humbling moment for me. And that was really the beginning of Daughterhood. But then my father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And then he also developed a very, very serious blood disorder called myelodysplastic syndrome, MDS, which is actually ended up being the disease that took his life. That was an extremely intense caregiving journey, short but intense. And there were just so many moments where I just thought, I knew this. I heard from lots of family caregivers in Daughterhood, and then to experience it, it's just really hard to understand it until you've been in it. Like, I'm an expert on home health. But when I'm sitting in my parents' house waiting for the home health nurse to show up and they're not there, and so then my mom and I have to figure out, we watched a YouTube video to remind ourselves how to flush a PICC line. Mm. And we were having all this trouble doing it. My mom is 80 something, you know, and we were forgetting to take the cap off. And I mean, all the nurses who did the training in the hospital were like, this is so easy, we'll show you. And then we get back and we're like, what are we not doing? So where is the home health nurse? And why are we having to learn how to do something like this on the YouTube video? It's hard to understand unless you're in it.
You mentioned that with your grandparents, you were third line caregiver, maybe somewhat involved, peripherally involved, but not in the trenches, so to speak. And it sounds like with your parents, you were much more first line. And I'm just wondering about the timeline of that. So when did that all start and how many years were you really in it? And then where are things now? Are you still in it or what's the status of your family?
I'll tell you one thing about us caregivers is we love to tell our stories. It's so therapeutic to do that. I'd be happy to share. So my father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in, I think, 2018. And he was high functioning, very independent. I was not doing really anything other than searching up where are the best Parkinson's doctors, you know, what is the latest? Where are the clinical trials? That kind of stuff. COVID started. And actually, my parents were the happiest they've been, I think, in their whole marriage. My dad has worked right up to the day he died, and he relaxed a little and he hung out with my mom and they were together and they were so happy. That was March of 2020. In November of 2020, his red cell counts and white cell counts and platelets just all started dropping just out of nowhere. So we had the Parkinson's, we were dealing with that. I mean, I know well enough from my professional life that we were facing a very long and hard road, but we weren't there yet. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he's got this serious health condition. And there's lots of different grades of this I've learned. He had the most serious possible. And so within just a few months, he was having to get regular infusions of blood. And then they put him on a course of chemotherapy. So going into 2021 was a year of me traveling frequently. So he was doing chemo, he was being hospitalized, he was getting infusions. It was just very intense medically. So that was kind of all of 2021. I got shingles.
Oh no.
I was so stressed out. I got shingles. And if anybody's ever had that, that's not fun. My son went off to college. So there was a lot going on in my life. It was very stressful. And then at the end of 2021, I really just went home and moved back in because my parents had not really faced my dad's mortality. They really thought there was going to be some kind of a cure. They were in deep denial when my mother finally started to wrap her brain around it. So I was at home with them alone, dealing with her grief, which was so intense and profound. My dad's alternating reality of like, I'm dying. And then I'm like, not going to face it that I'm dying. And basically living at the infusion center.
Yeah.
Hospice would not admit him because he was getting infusions and they're expensive. So they didn't want to take him. So we were at the infusion center practically three times a week, getting home health, going to the oncologist, dealing with just his diminishing physical strength. He couldn't really move around the house very well. And he needed help with a lot of things. And so my mom and I, we were just waiting on him hand and foot all day long. But the two of us, you know, making out medication sheets, everything we could to make him comfortable. He did not want to die, you know, and he was just going to keep doing these infusions. And so finally what ended up happening in the winter of 2022, I said goodbye. At Christmas time, I was planning to go back and visit end of January, beginning of February. And just like the day before I was scheduled to travel, his heart failed. They rushed him to the ER where he rescinded his do not resuscitate order.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that before.
Oh, okay, Dad. So he was really hanging on. So they intubated him, put him on life support, sent him to the CVICU. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a cardiovascular ICU. Gave my sister and me time to get there and meet with the palliative care team and make a decision and take him off life support, where he died very quickly and peacefully within like 20 minutes. Anyway, this is all to say it was very short relative to lots of family caregivers. It was about a year, but it was very intense. And then coming out of that, my mother, very high functioning, but you know, she's in her 80s. She didn't want to live in her house. She wanted to find another place to live, sell the house, do all the things. And she handled and managed a lot of it. She was amazing. And now she's in an independent living community in Wilmington, North Carolina, where she's going to exercise classes twice a week and has lots of friends. But it's a different relationship because she's now a widow. So where she and my dad were a team and they had each other, I didn't have to worry or think about how much I was engaging on a weekly, daily basis. Now, obviously, I'm just a lot more in trying and failing most of the time, but trying to be more attentive to my mom and what she needs emotionally. So that's where things stand.
Thank you so much for sharing that journey with us. I think what you're saying about the aftermath, like we focus a lot on the sick person and end of life and all of those intense emotions. But then there's this whole chapter afterward where there's a void and these two people who were orbiting each other for so long, one of them's out of orbit now. And there can be just a lot of change happening with the surviving spouse. I certainly noticed that with my father after my mother died of dementia. And we're still trying to figure out what's best for him. So now that you've shared all of that with us, you know, it sounds like it was a relatively short journey compared to some people living with dementia, but it was an intense journey nonetheless. And now you're sort of out of it the other side, or at least further along in the narrative. For our listeners, I'm wondering, given all of that, if there's one thing that you wish you had known going into that experience, if you could time travel back to yourself in 2018, what do you think you would say to yourself to prepare yourself?
I think I just would have prepared myself a little bit more for my father, very, very quickly going from being this larger than life rock star idol of mine who could do anything, to somebody who was almost entirely incapacitated. I think I would have prepared myself for that more. So my dad, the thing I have to say about him is that, you know, for his 80th birthday, we went zip lining in Costa Rica.
Wow.
Yeah. Like he bought a Mustang convertible and got a puppy that same year. And he was working full-time as a research scientist, like solving some of the most interesting and important problems in agricultural science in the world and traveling. And there wasn't anybody I liked to talk to more about what was going on in the world and what he thought. He was so proud of me and what I was doing. And so there was just this horrific moment where I was still treating him like he was my dad. And he was trying so hard, I'm going to start crying, but he was trying so hard to still be my dad. And we were at this mountain cabin, like all COVID cliches. I had bought this tiny little mess of a cabin in West Virginia, about an hour and a half from my house. And my dad was like, I'm going to come see it. You know, and so my mom drove him down. And I was like, come on, you got to see what it looks like from up on this hill. And you know, you're a physician. So you know, like, I was basically making a demand on his cardiovascular system that it could not do, but he was going to do it anyway. And I just, that's the part that I look back on with this, just that he walked up this hill and then he was really sick, just vomiting, like just sick, like that moment. But he and I both wanted him to still be that person in my life who was going to tell me how I needed to think about this problem I had, you know, like, where's the rain going to go? And it, you know, like, are you going to take down these trees or not? Like, and then he also built a fire in the fireplace, taught me how to use my wood burning stove. And he got down on the floor and then he couldn't get back up. Every step along the way, it was sort of like, I just couldn't believe it was happening. because that's not my reality. My reality is my dad is this person who can build anything, solve anything, fix anything, talk about anything, to this guy who was just like really exhausted and sick. He had hospital delirium. And this is a man who's so proud to get up in a hospital gown and walk around. That just wasn't the relationship that we had. So the emotional adjustment had to happen so quickly, and it was so dramatic. I think that more than anything is what I would go back and explain that was going to happen.
And when you're dealing with these rapid changes that have to do with things like function and activities you can do together as a family, but also just things like identity and who we are. Mm-hmm. With dementia in particular, it's a disease of the brain. Yeah. And there is just so much bound up in there. It can be really isolating to be going through that alone, or even going through it, sounds like maybe with your mom going through it together, but still as a family can feel really isolating. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to that feeling of isolation, and then about the birth of daughterhood, this community online, and how you got the idea and how that idea was born into the world.
Daughterhood, more than anything for me as a health policy and aging researcher, was like an anthropological project for a while. It was like an opportunity to really talk to people and hear firsthand personal lived experiences. And in doing that, even before my dad got sick, what I was hearing in the qualitative data over and over and over again were three things that all family caregivers experience. And by the way, people experiencing dementia, everything is similar, but just on steroids. So whatever the challenge, it's just an order of magnitude harder when it's somebody with dementia. And there are some unique aspects, obviously, of that experience to do with the ambiguous loss around this person's here, but they're not here, and you miss them, but they're here. All of that is very unique to dementia. But these other things we see across the spectrum are the feeling of being overwhelmed, the feeling of not ever being able to do enough, and the feeling of being profoundly alone. And it's those three things. And what's interesting about caregiving, I've observed, is that every single family's and individual situation has got all of these little unique little nuggets and nooks and crannies. And like, you know, my sister has a boyfriend who does the thing, and then mom won't, and then the thing, and the car, and the house, and the, you know, it's like all of those things that are unique to that family's situation and finances and all of that is running along the top. So what makes it so hard, I think, for any company to come in and help, everybody's always looking for these things called scalable solutions, right? You want to scale solutions, which just means being able to serve a lot of people at the same time. It's hard to serve a lot of people when every single person's situation is completely different. So we have that, but then underneath it, despite all of those differences, we have the three core emotional experiences and the isolation and the loneliness. It's hard to say which one is the worst, but I think that the other two wouldn't be so bad if it weren't for the loneliness. And it's so hard to describe the loneliness. And so my own experience of it is that it's like being inside a fishbowl. You're like looking out at the rest of the world, and you're trapped all by yourself in this other reality while you're watching the regular world go by. And I remember feeling just angry. On Christmas Day in 2021, my dad was really sick. When he was feeling a little bit better 2 days before, he had said, "Would you make macaroni and cheese for Christmas Day dinner? I'm craving macaroni and cheese." I'm like, on it. I mean, I researched. I was like, barefoot Contessa, mac and cheese. Like, I was like going to do the, I was making the best mac and cheese in the whole wide world. And then the day came and he couldn't eat it. He was too sick that day. And my mom was crying the whole day. And we were just like, we just got to get through this. And I took their dog out for a walk, and I'm walking and I'm seeing all these other families walking together happily, multi-generations. Like my kids would have been there, the dogs and my sister. And it was just the three of us in this very sad situation. And that's the loneliness, right? It's like, yeah, my girlfriend came over and checked on me and we had a good conversation, but it's just like, there's not a lot you can do about it. You're in this situation that is kind of separate from the rest of the world. And you feel like you're watching everybody else have a good life while you suffer, or your family member suffers. But daughterhood came about even before my father got sick because of some other situations going on in my family, which I'm not free to talk about, and some stuff that a couple of my neighbors were bringing to me. And so kind of all at one time, I was being asked a lot of questions about the healthcare system and the long-term care system that I couldn't answer because I didn't even I was like, what are you talking about that's happening to you? And I had just really thought that if you had money, you're fine. The problems that I was trying to solve up to that point were, we need to make sure everybody has enough money to pay for care. We have to improve the Medicaid program. Not everybody wants to be in a nursing home, like those kinds of things. But what I learned in that moment was that because our long-term care system is so profoundly underfunded, we don't have a way of actually paying for those services and supports in this country, that even when you do have money to pay for things, they're just not there. You just can't, you can't find them. I always say it's a little bit like trying to drive a fancy car down a dirt road. There's no road. So when I learned that and I had that epiphany, I really wanted to systematically talk to people and do that qualitative research all on my own, unfunded, and start to write down my observations. And pretty quickly, it was one of those moments where I'm writing about how caregiving makes motherhood look like a walk in the park. I wrote something like daughterhood. It was just the word came to me. And then I had this wonderful young, brilliant friend who was like, all right, that's it. That's what we're doing. She helped me get the website up. She's like, you need to just start writing regularly. This is important. People need to see this and read it and be part of it. And honestly, everything after that was just organic. It was like the blogs were a lot of work. Like, let me say, but everything else was, you know, people would read the blogs and they would reach out. They'd ask me questions or they would want to come together around this. So we started this thing called Daughterhood Circles, which are now virtual and online, and they're offered every week. And we have now a podcast that is led by this incredibly talented and brilliant woman named Roseanne Corcoran. And I still write blogs, and we're working on improving our website and growing our community. And we went from sort of just off the sides of our desk to creating a nonprofit with a board. And I think where we're going with it is, you know, I don't know. I'm supposed to know. But I think it changes every day. It makes everybody around me crazy. But I think that I want to continue to grow the community because I believe there's power in that community to help actually affect change. And that's probably where I can add the most value, is to play the role of bringing that community's voice to the policy conversation that's going on, because we have to make some really big changes and there has to be a lot of political will because it's hard. So that's sort of the journey that we've been on. But the best part of it is, like, I'll just give you one more example. So I was having this great conversation with a bunch of caregiver circle leaders, and we're talking about healthcare at home. So in Washington, D.C., during COVID, like, healthcare at home was this very sexy topic, home-based medical care, doing a hospital-based stuff at home and everything. And the caregivers were all talking about how really that's just like the caregivers doing all the healthcare at home. Because, like, that's what always happens. Hospice, home health, it just ends up being the caregiver does all the work. So I actually pitched a project to AARP, and we wrote a paper over at ATI. We wrote a paper on all of the considerations for family caregivers when you're doing a hospital at home program. So the daughterhood community absolutely feeds the work that I do to try to elevate these issues in a policy context.
You talked about how long-term care is sorely underfunded in the United States. And I'm wondering if you could paint a picture for me about the state of policy around caregiving in the United States, and maybe how does it compare to other countries? Like, how are we doing? Where are the gaps? What do we need? my sense is that we're in a pretty awful place with policy right now, that there's still a lot of work to be done, but maybe you can just paint a picture for our audience about where things stand and where things might go.
Because it can be incredibly frustrating as a family caregiver to come into this and be like, why is this all so broken? A really important piece of context here is part of the reason why, and this gets to all of the other countries as well, we're all in the same boat, which is that we've gained 20 years of life expectancy just since I was born. And we have our largest generation entering their 70s now and expecting to live on average 10, 15, 20 years, depending on what demographic you're in, longer than you could have expected in the 50s and 60s. So that is really a profound shift to have to make in programs and systems in a really short period of time. So we just started the Medicare and Medicaid programs in the 60s. Now that seems like a really long time ago, but these are massive, massive, massive programs to stand up and operate across the country. And there's zillions and zillions of different organizations and providers and people who have all these vested interests. And the Medicare program, which is the health insurance program for older adults that almost every older adult is covered under, is now putting out $1 trillion a year in money just to pay for healthcare for older adults. That's just a phenomenal number. All to say, it's a little bit like trying to move the Titanic, right? You got to take $1 trillion and you're like, we spend a lot of that money in not very smart ways and we need to pay for long-term care and not so much hospital care. Like, why are we spending so much money on surgeries when people need food and all of this shifting we need to do to really prepare an infrastructure and a system for this population that's on the horizon? It is a very challenging thing to do. It's just hard. So the situation that we're in right now is that we spend a lot of money on expensive medical care, prescription drugs, and not very much money on long-term care, which is the day-to-day supports and services for somebody who's challenged in doing things for themselves, dementia population being the primary one that needs supervision and support on a daily basis over a long term. That stuff's not covered. If you go to the hospital, that is covered. So that's the fundamental problem, is that we are spending money in the wrong places. And so a lot of family caregivers are having to essentially be the care delivery system. And that has ripple effects, of course, through the rest of the economy.
They leave their jobs to do this work. Yeah, so they're out of the workforce
all the time, especially when it's a family member with dementia. Because there's so much work that goes into it. Whether you're the hands-on caregiver, or even if your family member is in a nursing home or assisted living facility, there's still falls and they're going to the hospital and you're a partner in that care with those providers, best case scenario. You can't check out. I mean, you're still very involved. So it's a big job and it's very hard to do paid work and that at the same time. I think other countries are much farther along than we are in the sense that they all have long-term care financing systems. So they have money flowing in and just, I would say, like the poster child's always for Germany and the Netherlands and the Scandinavian countries, but they have their challenges too. It's not perfect anywhere, but they're much farther along, as often is the case with social insurance programs.
So talk to us about the GUIDE model for the audience. GUIDE stands for Guiding an Improved Dementia Experience Model. My understanding is this is a federal program. So can you explain to us what it is and how it works?
Sure. So this is exciting. It's kind of one of those things that's like, it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal. So the GUIDE model is a new way for the federal government to pay for healthcare providers, like primary care physicians, so that they can be a lot more involved in providing what people and caregivers need to take care of dementia. And the reason I'm kind of being awkward in the way I say that is I just want to share with the audience what the like wonky language is. It offers an alternative payment for providers that are delivering what's called a comprehensive dementia care model. So what that really means is that instead of what you're used to as a caregiver, which is having to navigate across all of these different silos of care. So you go and you talk to your primary care doctor, and that person doesn't talk to the neurologist, and the neurologist doesn't know anything about what's going on in your long-term care. And you, the caregiver, are basically the only neurotransmitter across all those different nodes of care delivery. So the idea that the government is putting forward is, what if instead of paying for each one of those little nodes separately, what if we took some of that money and we put it together into one bucket and we gave it to one organization and made them responsible for managing it? And this is the really innovative thing. Within that bucket of money, there's some money designated to pay for things specifically to help the caregiver. So rather than centering the care exclusively on the person who has dementia, it's treating the primary family caregiver and the person with dementia as what we call a dyad. And it's focusing resources on that pairing with the recognition that that family caregiver is integral to the health of the person with dementia. And that is revolutionary in Medicare policy. We've never seen anything like that. I mean, it was just a year and a half ago, I was on the phone with people in the federal government who were saying, no way would Medicare ever pay for anything for family caregivers because that is not who the program is for. To now, under the leadership of President Biden and Chiquita White, who's the administrator, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, recognizing that that is just not the reality. The reality is when an individual has dementia, the family caregiver is like an extension of that person in many respects. And so it is smarter from a financial perspective for the federal government to put money towards serving that pairing and making sure that family caregiver is supported and has respite. So respite care services are included in this comprehensive care model, care coordination, care management, access to a clinical support line 24/7, caregiver assessments and counseling. And the most interesting thing to me is helping to connect that pairing, that dyad, to the social community-based services. Those won't necessarily be paid for, but at least you're not trying to find that and navigate it all on your own. So that's all the good news. The bad news is that this is just what's called a demonstration program.
It's like a pilot program.
It's a pilot. So basically what the government does is it invites providers to apply to participate in the pilot. And so that means it won't necessarily be everywhere. It will be in areas where there are providers who are interested in and capable of delivering this level of support for the money that's been put on the table. So right now we're going through the application process, then the model will launch and it will run for 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think based on what we've seen in our work at ATI, my day job, is that a lot of organizations are really interested in applying. We're seeing a lot of interest. So I'm excited about it. I guess if I had one complaint, which I don't, but I do, it would be, I wish we could just mandate this. This should just be the thing that we all do for people with dementia. Why are we waiting and testing it for 8 years? Like, let's just go already. And I think that's what I hear from family caregivers when I get excited, like, oh, look, caregiver training is being reimbursed. They're like, whoop-de-doo. Why don't we reimburse in home care? And this is like a little too late kind of a feeling if you're in the middle of it. From an expert kind of perspective, I look at it and go, this is still a pretty big shift. And it's better that we're at least having the conversation than, you know, we're still operating under this idea that not that many people have dementia when it's really quite a lot of people.
It's quite a lot of people and it's going to become more and more. And I think we'll see what happens in 8 years. Maybe the more people who learn about GUIDE and the more outcry there is publicly, maybe we can hit the gas on this and get it going faster. I learned so much from that explanation, and I know I'm going to have that in mind as my dad ages for sure. As we wrap up, I was wondering if you could maybe leave us with a moment, a story, an idea of hope, of love, of connection. You know, maybe it's something from your family life, or maybe it's something from your professional and policy life. Just something to give us some hope as we move forward on this journey.
What I am seeing right now is the care needs of Americans in general, older adults, younger adults with disabilities, individuals with mental health needs are becoming more complex. And family caregivers are playing an increasingly important role. And there's a groundswell of recognition of that all of a sudden. So I've been working on this really intently, you know, since about 2015. I remember giving a speech and saying, this is a silent crisis. You're a family caregiver, you feel like you're in it all alone. And I'm saying right now, there almost isn't a day that goes by now where I don't see discussions in the press, in policy conversations, in actual policy decisions like this one. The White House is talking about it. Congress is talking about it. So I really see a lot of change on the horizon. And I feel incredibly hopeful about what is possible when family caregivers do come together and join their voices to say, there's a better way and we can do it. And maybe just to be very hopeful, there's a lot of discussion about how lacking in unity we are as a country in the U.S. Caregiving is a unifier. It's a unifying experience. It really transcends socio-demographics. Those three things I was talking about, feeling overwhelmed, feeling guilty, feeling alone, is universal. No matter where you live, what your politics are, how much money you have, what the skin color is, what your gender identity, all of that goes away. And I see this incredible coming together of all of these different types of people when it comes to this issue. So how amazing would it be if we let caring and caregiving actually be one of the things that starts to kind of bring all of us back together again to move forward in a way that works for everyone? That's the kind of silver lining that I see in all of it.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on. And I want to thank you so much for your generosity today, for sharing about you and your family, and also for explaining a bit about the amazing work that you're doing with healthcare policy and for presenting it in such an easily understandable way. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm just so grateful that you came to Remo to chat with me.
Oh, I've enjoyed it very much. You are a great facilitator.
All right. Thank you. Take care and have a wonderful day.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. For more information about this episode, check out the links and resources listed in the show notes. If you're interested in learning more from Remo, visit us at www.remo.health. Take care.